You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, Spine Number 81, RoboCop, and Paul Verhoeven's other super pervy freakouts, featuring robots, cops, robot cops, mutants, rapists, mutant rapists, ice picks, strippers, hookers, bugs, Rutger Hauer, sexy nuns, sexy Jesus, Nazis, sexy Nazis, mercenaries, bikers, invisible men, invisible rapists, and that one guy getting his dick shot off. Martin.
Yes.
Bitches, leave. Welcome back to another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining me as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, we're doing RoboCop, which we're now 81 movies in officially. If we're just counting spine numbers, we're not counting bonus episodes and miniseries and interviews and all that bullshit. But truth be told, it's somewhat shocking that it took us this long to be like, RoboCop? We should do RoboCop. Like, RoboCop's a no-brainer, right?
Yes, yeah. It kind of reminds me when we were talking about Darkman and just this formative fucking movie in my life, especially as a young, when I was a young kid. And first time we saw it was on TV. We didn't have cable. And so we taped it.
I'm pretty sure me too.
That's first way. But for me, it was the music that got me. And like,
oh, the Basil Palladora score.
And he's like, next to Goldsmith, my favorite composer, because of obviously Conan. But this score rips so hard. I remember just being like, this is the coolest fucking movie. It still looks cool. I just showed it to Val for the first time, and she was like, that was great. I'm like, and it's yeah. Like, it plays 2025 with a new audience super well. It's like, it's got everything, which we can talk a lot about with Verhoeven, of just like, you get your cake and you eat it too.
I think it's sort of like, it's weird. I've been thinking about this lately, about some of the stuff we talk about when it comes to like formative movies that we experience for, at, you know, usually on cable or TV, like you said, and you taped it and you watched it again and again. But movies like RoboCop or The Fly is another one that kind of comes to mind.
Predator and Terminator, the 80s sci-fi action horror.
Commando's another one. But I was thinking about, like, what is it about these movies that, like, Darkman is actually another one too.
Yeah.
Is that what is it about these types of movies that unifies them and kind of makes them appeal to not only like 12-year-old you, but like also 42-year-old you? Is that like, it's a concept that you can latch on to even as a kid. Like, this movie is about a robot who's also a cop and fights bad guys in Detroit. The Fly, it's very simple. It's about a guy who turns into a fly. And he becomes a gross monster. You know, movies like that. Darkman, guy loses his face, becomes a superhero by wearing other people's faces, makes like fake skin.
Right.
You know, and only has 90 minutes basically to, you know, wear that. Is that, you know, they're all very, very simplistic, pulpy concepts.
Yeah. High concept.
Yeah, high concepts. But then you apply an auteur's touch. A Paul Verhoeven, a David Cronenberg, a Sam Raimi, you know, that, and then all of a sudden these very high concepts or very sturdy ideas then become cinema, because it's guys who have a lot more on their mind other than, you know, we're just going to deliver the goods for 90 minutes, which they do. That's the beauty of these movies we've kind of singled out, and particularly RoboCop, is you can watch RoboCop as a 12-year-old kid, and it's the greatest fucking thing you've ever seen in your life, because it has, to your point, everything. As dudes getting blown away by robots, it has a robot cop, it has a big, scary robot cop in Ed 209, It has clearly defined bad guys and punks and, you know, Clarence Boddicker. And even, like, when you're a kid, like, Dick Jones and the corporate types, you can tell, like, you look at them as you're a kid, and you're like, oh, they're bad.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it's...
Beyond the extra context of the 80s.
Exactly. Right. And yeah. It's Verhoeven very clearly being like, here's a guy who's on a mission, he was done wrong, he becomes a robot, and he takes out the bad guys. It's the same thing with The Fly. It's like, here's this romance, this guy has a terrible accident, he becomes a monster, the girl tries to save him, can't in the end. Darkman's very much the same kind of tragic romance as The Fly, is that it's like, here's a guy, gets caught up in a bad situation, has a terrible accident, creates these superpowers for himself, but ultimately just wants to get back to the woman he loves and can't. Like, they're very... For as high concept as they are, they deal with emotions that aren't complex. It's very much good, evil, right, wrong, vengeance, and love.
Yeah, they're elemental, right?
Exactly.
And they all have, I think of four movies when I, you know, it's, you have RoboCop, you have Terminator, you have Aliens, and you have Predator, right? And they all have been versus each other. And I always think of Dark Horse Comics, right, which have covered all of these properties.
Predator's another great example. Bunch of commandos in the jungle, get attacked by a killer alien. That's it.
Well, and you have to give credit, too, to the special effects people of that time. You have the Rob Bottins and the Stan Winstons, right, who were stars in their own right, you know? And famously, Stan Winston comes in late on Predator when they already had a really bad version of the monster.
The Lobster Man.
The Lobster Man, played by Jean-Claude Van Damme, and then does this, you know, off the seat of his pants, amazing, one of the best, you know, movie villains or movie monsters of all time. And I think it's like they really stand the test of time because there are these timeless looking, they're badass in their own way. But you also have this sense of like extreme gore in all these movies too, which I think for a 12-year-old,
yeah,
you really, I mean, obviously Verhoeven being the goriest, but that
Cronenberg.
Well, sorry, I'm obviously about these four movies, but like, yeah. But Cronenberg for sure, of like you're saying, you take away any kind of subtext and you're like, this is just a really good horror movie or a good action movie. And I remember like the first time I saw RoboCop when I was like, but later time when I saw it and kind of got what was going on, I think I was like 16 and I was like taking sociology classes in high school and stuff. And I was like, wait, is this actually about something?
Right.
And then it really dawned on me. And to kind of to your point too, it's like this flower opening of like this movie that I already love on one level and can still turn my brain off and watch on that level. This movie fucking rips. It rules. It's gory. It's fun. The special effects are amazing. Peter Weller really fucking rules as RoboCop and Murphy.
And you don't need any context to enjoy a man getting melted by toxic waste and then getting exploded by an oncoming truck.
Truly one of the nastiest, coolest effects I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah, incredible stuff.
What a way to fucking go.
Poor Emil.
Yes. When it's funny that we talked about this Darkman, you know, being this like proto or early in the comic book boom, obviously not based on anything because he couldn't get the shadow rights for Sam Raimi, is I feel like all these movies, they do have the setup of a comic book movie just ahead of their time and creating IPs without relying on an IP ahead of time.
Sure.
And they're also hard R, which we just don't get anymore. So we have the kind of nostalgia of that era of these big budget action horror films that had, you know, monster budgets and great special effects. Do we really get that anymore? Not really.
Not entirely, no. I mean, we certainly don't on a genre level like we used to.
Right.
But we also don't have many filmmakers or any, frankly, who are Paul Verhoeven. You know, because that's the thing. You know, we kind of went down the rabbit hole together because Paul Verhoeven's always been one of my guys. And as we rewatched a lot of these movies, you know, I kind of came to realize that, like, for me, he's on the same level as like a Cronenberg or a De Palma,
right,
or a Michael Mann or something, because like I watch his films and I get so much out of them. Take all the subtext away, just from a pure craftsmanship standpoint. Like, he's a guy who clearly was just born to make movies and understood how images moved, and also, like, frankly, how cinematic sex and violence both are. Like, you want to talk about he might be cinema's, like, finest pervert, the side of pornography, you know, because he's just a guy who he comprehends the intrinsic appeal of, like, seeing a pair of tits or seeing a man get shot 40 times or seeing a space marine get dismembered by a giant, like, alien bug, or watching Sharon Stone flash her vagina, or Elizabeth Berkley get on stage and shake her ass, or Gina Gershon, or, like, he's just, it's lizard brain shit, but he executes all of it at such a high level that, like, it's that strange meeting of, like, art and perversion that very few filmmakers in history have ever pulled off on that scale with that budget.
Yeah, 100%. And I think watching all these, and I'm, for the record, a big Verhoeven fan, not to your level, but I mean, like, 5 or 6 of his movies are, like, in my pantheon of favorites. I mean, RoboCop is probably a top 10 movie. Like, it's untouchable for me.
Well, you had never really explored a lot of his Dutch stuff, which was kind of cool to go through with you, because like, you were watching a lot of these for the first time. Like, shit like Soldier of Orange, you'd never seen before. And that's an incredible war epic, but is also unlike anything he really did in America.
Well, the connection I drew between that, what opened up this time for me, and first of all, I want to make a point. I agree about the sex, the sex on the highest level of production value. I think what I noticed, and we texted about it, is here's a director who has his cake and eats it too.
Oh, yeah.
That you get to see the thing. You get to see the goriest shit, to your point, like dismemberment, you know, guys melting with, you know, toxic waste. You get to see some of the sexiest shit ever put in a rated R, almost NC-17 movie, or NC-17 for the case of Showgirls. And at the same time,
which is less sexy.
Oh, it's less sexy
than Basic Instinct.
But at the same time, he puts this mirror back on himself. There's, like, self-judgment in his depictions. And also it kind of, I'm not saying he's judging the audience, but I think specifically about one of the best scenes he ever did, beyond it being sexy, is the flashing of her vagina in Basic Instinct. Because you have, it's all about the reaction of these actors, and it's amazing. You have, you know, Wayne Knight leaning forward, wiping his brow, and they're completely eating out of the palm of her hand. And so it's sexy, but it's also fucking hilarious, because it is this, like, silent word, this kind of this silent play of power, you know, of her, and also Sharon Stone, the point she was in her career, being the sexiest actress in Hollywood. But what I noticed with, like, Soldier of Orange, and then moving into, like, his films in America, was the sense of having characters who understand they're playing a part. You have, or especially in Soldier of Orange, if you have these guys playing at being soldiers, it never feels like they're true soldiers, right? From the beginning, very connected to where we are in America right now, of, like, the slow rise of fascism, and it's not going to touch us. It's not going to touch our family and friends. And eventually, you got to get involved in some way. They're still so playful about it. They still just want to get laid. These characters want to just get laid. And you have that in Flesh and Blood of, like, they're playing at being heroes. They're playing into, oh, we all wear red because we follow St. Martin. RoboCop is also, like, this idea of the corporate America playing at being cops. It's this, like, facade. Does it make sense?
Yes, because it stretches all the way back to, you know, some of his earliest Dutch movies, like Katie Tipple, which were about prostitutes and about how all men are looking for women to play a specific role for them.
Exactly.
And how that power dynamic kind of can change depending on what role everybody chooses to play. But I mean, like, even Starship Troopers,
100%,
is very much, you know, if you took the basic narrative of a bunch of college friends who go in various directions during the Nazi occupation in World War II, and some decide to become resistance fighters and some decide to become collaborators. I mean, he just takes that and transplants it into space and makes it an even more overt satirical comment on the rise of fascism and everything, because it's literally about, here's a rich kid in Johnny Rico who could escape to like a paradise and avoid the war entirely, but decides to enlist against his parents' wishes. Then, you know, again, that whole planet gets fucking nuked by the bugs.
Yeah.
But then you also have kind of his lower class friend and Dizzy who enlists to be a Marine. Then you have his other love interest who goes into, you know, the actual Fleet Academy and yeah. how these lives kind of continue to crisscross and converge yeah. during this space war against the bugs. But it's like, that's just Soldier of Orange again,
yeah.
but with giant arachnids fighting people and decapitating them, you know? It's kind of like how L is a retread of a lot of, you know, the same themes that he explored in Basic Instinct,
yep. Power,
and Black Book,
yep.
and in Dutch, The Fourth Man.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and like, they're... He's revisiting these things to where, like, The Fourth Man almost feels like a dry run for Basic Instinct when you go and watch it. Soldier of Orange feels like a dry run for Starship Troopers. The thing about RoboCop that's so unique inside of his filmography is there really isn't a dry run for it. There's stuff that predicts it as it goes on. Like, you could say, like, Flesh and Blood, which is very much almost like a Sam Peckinpah movie, but set during the Crusades. It's almost like a Crusades version of The Wild Bunch,
oh,
if
totally.
You think about it in the abstract.
I never thought about that, yeah.
And, like, so you can see how he loves violence in the same way that Peckinpah loved violence and these rough men and codes of honor and, like, what appeals to men on, like, a very primal level. But, like, RoboCop... There wasn't another, like, template for it, even inside of his own filmography. He kind of came out after the failure of Flesh and Blood and was like, okay, I'm going to make this project that's more or less like a for-hire gig.
Yeah.
And, but he makes a Paul Verhoeven movie out of it to where it becomes another Jesus allegory, like he does, and he loves to explore his religious themes inside of his movies, but it becomes about a guy who's crucified by these gang members, rises from the dead in 3 days, and becomes Detroit's savior, only instead of being Detroit's savior through peace, he's Detroit's savior through large caliber firearms.
Yeah.
And dude, Peter Weller... was like born to play RoboCop. Like,
Robo One Oreo.
Yeah, Robo One Oreo. God, what a crazy documentary.
Yeah. For the listeners who haven't seen it, basically there's a story where, and it famously one of the most uncomfortable movie suits of all time. Like, they had to have fans pumping underneath it because it was just hot as fuck and heavy. And there's a scene where it's, I think it's the shootout at the steel mill at the end.
Right.
And he's standing up there, and one of the special effects guys is eating Oreos. And I guess Peter Weller was just like, Robo want Oreo. And the guy's like, mm-mm. I guess he's very difficult to work with anyway.
He's like, does Peter want an Oreo?
And he's like, no, Robo want Oreo. And then the guy takes all his Oreos and shoves them in his mouth and eats them in front of Peter Weller, who gets really fucking pissed. And on the interview, on the documentary, Peter Weller was like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Like, it never happened. He's funnily surly.
Yeah, well, they also say he's very method for right. the Robo One Oreo part is that he required... He's another one of these maniacs who, like, requires the crew to only refer to him as RoboCop and will only speak in, like, the RoboCop dialect, you know, once he becomes a robot and everything. Like, that's the thing is, this... set didn't sound like the most functional set of all time. Like, Verhoeven, not known for being a gentle director.
Yeah.
In fact, he's known for being almost like a screeching banshee on set, where he acts out all of the different, like, there are, when you find behind the scenes footage of him directing, like, he'll act out every part in front of, like, the crew, to where, like, on Starship Troopers, like, he was being the bugs and, like, flapping his arms and screeching the way the bugs were. And, like, when he's mapping out the scene where Ed 209, like, massacres that dude in the conference room, which I have questions, like, logistically about that whole scene. I always have ever since I was, like, a little kid. Namely being, like, So for a work demonstration, you loaded that robot with live ammunition? Like, at no point was anyone like, maybe you should use blanks? It's like, nah, fuck that guy. We're going to shoot him 90 times. But anyway, but like, you know, Verhoeven would be Ed 209. He would thunk around and he would make the robot noises and he would run and screech in people's faces and do whatever. Like, he was an absolute maniac. Have you ever heard the story Wayne Knight tells about being cast in Basic Instinct?
No.
Well, apparently Verhoeven knew him, I think, from Seinfeld, but this might be too early for Seinfeld. I don't know where.
No, this is, it's 92.
92.
So this is after Seinfeld's what, 89?
I don't think Newman's on it yet, though.
Okay.
He's a recurring character.
But he was early, yeah.
He's pretty early.
This is the year before Jurassic Park, too. So, right. Yeah.
But he knows Wayne Knight, and he requests to interview Wayne Knight, and he calls Wayne Knight apparently up to a hotel room, and Wayne Knight goes there. You can find a video of Wayne Knight telling this story, and it's fucking hysterically funny the way he tells it, is because he's just doing it in that very, like, nebbish Wayne Knight way. He's like, okay, and it's this Dutch guy, and he opens the door and he's got a camera and he's like, come in. Yeah, sit down over there. And he's like, okay. All I want you to do is lick your lips. And Wayne Knight's like, all right. And he licks his lips once. He's like, okay. Now again, do it slower. Lick your lips. And Wayne Knight's like, okay. So I lick it again, put a little extra spit on it this time, you know, thinking like, maybe that's the one. He goes, oh, that's good. I lick it even slower. And Wayne Knight's like, what the fuck is this guy's deal? Like, but apparently he just has this handheld camera the whole time and he's just interviewing him, but he's doing the scene from Basic Instinct in the way of, like, to your point, like, the reactions of the people that Sharon Stone was flashing her vagina to were almost as important, if not more important, than the act of her flashing herself, which I guess also years later it came out that she didn't fully know, maybe, that he was going to show the vagina on screen, which also calls into, like, Paul Verhoeven, like, if we're going to say he was the most ethical filmmaker in the world, not so much.
Yeah.
But, like, he's a pervert. But I also think that he, in the same way that De Palma does to a certain degree, he embraces the fact that, like, hey, man, I like hot women. I like violence. I like sex. I like watching squibs explode. I like cum. And, like, you know, like, it's just, and like, it's just kind of the same thing of, like, when you think about Hollow Man, which is a movie I've really warmed to over the years.
Oh, I love it so much.
Is that, like, the main question of that movie is literally, like, what if a guy who already had, let's say, a predilection towards sexual violence or perversion, what if he was able to become the Invisible Man? Would that guy just go out and rape and fondle women with, you know, basically no consequences? And the answer is yes.
Well, think about Basic Instinct and think about Hollow Man. And what I like about Verhoeven is he admits, I'm a pervert, right? But also, I think we all are, right? I think there's a hatred for hypocrisy within his movies of many sorts, religious hypocrisy, social hypocrisy. But I think that's the thing is, especially with Basic Instinct, of like, that scene is funny of her flashing them. But it's also like, if you're a 14-year-old kid, you're leaning forward, right? Like, there's like, you know, your first time you see it, or if you're, you know, 42 watching it again, you're like, it's a sexy fucking scene. And so he toes that line so well of enjoyment and judgment too, of like, he's also like, hey, but we're all like this. Like, this is calling this thing out.
My thing is I don't know how much he judges you for being into it. I think he more or less turns the mirror on to you and is like, you like this too.
Yeah.
Like, don't.
But this is also what you look like. So regardless of judgment, you're this guy licking his lips.
Exactly.
We're all the guys in the room right now.
I don't know how much judgment he's actually kind of throwing out there with it. I think he's honest,
right,
about the fact that we all like to get laid and we all like to watch violence. And, like, there's something inherently cinematic about those things, and he exploits that to his own gain. I mean, it's also very much, his movies are about the power dynamics that come with sex and violence, with, like, you know, Black Book is entirely about a woman utilizing her sexuality to further the resistance efforts against the Nazis, right down to, has one of the great Verhoeven scenes of all time, of when she realizes that, you know, she's a Jewish girl basically in hiding, bleaching her hair blonde so she can fall in with the Aryan Brotherhood and the Nazis and become their, like, concubine. She bleaches her pussy hairs.
Yeah.
And it's like, she realizes, it's like, this is not only what they expect it to look like, but it's what they like too. So, and she has to your point, also play the part. And Elle is probably the most complicated.
That is an uncomfortable movie in all the right ways, though.
Yeah.
I think as from a male viewer perspective,
I think from any viewer perspective, yeah. I would probably argue it's probably more uncomfortable for a woman to watch that movie.
No, I would agree. I'm just saying, like, I'm just speaking from my perspective of, like, I'm uncomfortable with what I feel.
But I also like that, like, me, you, and our buddy Shapiro have this discussion all the time where we, all three of us, diverge on different paths when it comes to what movies make us feel. Is that, you know, he's the most extreme example of the three of us, is he loves stuff that makes you feel bad. And, like, he relishes in it because he, a almost direct quote from him is that, you know, it takes a lot of effort for someone and commitment for someone to make you feel that awful, or to make you, to elicit that kind of level of emotion from you. To where I'm probably in the middle of the three of us, to where, like, I really like sad, feel bad stuff, more sad than anything. Where, like, James likes, like, hyper depressing, like, Russian cinema and shit. But, like, I like sad stuff, and you are more of, like, the, you like it, but, like, in doses.
It's funny, I agree, because, and it's, there's certain subgenres and, like, you know, international films, like, I love Nordic sad Swedish shit because of my, where I'm from. Same thing, I love Russian too, Tarkovsky. But when it comes to feeling bad, it's usually shock stuff. Like, I want to see, like, French New Extremity, I'm good all day. Like, as fucked up as that is,
but, like, Eddington, not your thing, because you don't like to feel uncomfortable. You don't like things that give you anxiety.
Well, we talked before. I think Nathan Fielder is one of the smartest, most brilliant people on the planet. I can't watch his stuff.
Or Curb Your Enthusiasm. Same thing. You don't like Curb because you don't like that uncomfortable, cringy feeling.
No, my mom tells the joke, because we would watch comedies, and I would hide under a blanket. Like, I get more scared by, like, uncomfortable. Like, same with reality TV. I don't like people fighting. It's some deep shit I talk to my therapist about. But, like, I'll watch the most fucked up horror stuff all day long. That's fine for me. But, like, Whiplash is my hell. Like, my hell is Whiplash. I watched that movie, I'm like, my fear is being chastised by a male authority figure. That's it. I was like, this movie is just my nightmare for fucking 2 hours. So, yeah. Do not want to watch that again.
But Verhoeven with Elle is, like, really, that's almost, like, the most Verhoeven movie of all time, because it's about a woman who, frankly, creates a deep bond with her rapist. And then they have a psychosexual attachment to one another that develops in an almost, like, Hitchcockian thriller style. And it's, like, it's all of his stuff rolled into one movie with an Isabelle Huppert performance at the center that's, like, fucking incredible, you know? And but that might be his cringiest movie, the one that makes, that's the hardest to sit through.
Well, that's what's, you know, so I played at Fantastic Fest that year.
It did.
And I didn't see it there, and I watched it a few years later, because I always catch up with Verhoeven eventually. He's one of those directors. I'm like, I'm definitely going to see it. And what surprised me was how entertaining. I remember, he's such an entertaining director, no matter what the subject matter is. And
it plays as a straight thriller.
It does. And he's so interesting because he's also such a talented filmmaker, just flat out great director, like great blocking, just the basics, right? And I remember watching that movie and then same with Benedetta, is for moments you're just like, oh, this is just like a normal period piece or a normal like sex or a normal drama. And there's always a moment where you're like, oh, never mind, it's Verhoeven. Like he'll pop in and remind you, like, Jesus beheading fucking people. Dude,
the warrior Jesus segment in Benedetta is batshit insane.
And hilarious. And you know he's trying to make us laugh. It's so fucking good.
Which is also hilarious coming from him because he's a guy who's worked on the Jesus Project and has written books about the life of Christ. And like, it's a subject that's actually very near and dear to his heart, but almost not in like a religious way. Like he likes the life of Christ and has explored the life of Christ from like a pure, like almost historical
or standpoint. Narrative, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah. Cause he wanted to make a movie about Jesus and has been trying to make a movie about Jesus for like years. He also tried to make a movie about the Crusades with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I didn't know that till you told me at the bar and it made me hurt that we never got that. That's like one of those movies. It's almost
and that
like,
was during the 90s, during peak, like post Total Recall.
For both of them, huge stars.
Exactly,
huge.
Where they could have actually gotten it done.
Well, and you know, think about a director too, like him, is compare similar subject matter with the same star of Piano Teacher and Elle. Could not be more different. Haneke, one of my favorite filmmakers, but now that's a dreary fucking time.
Like, oh, God.
Piano Teacher is one of the least fun movies I've ever seen. L,
unlike the other romps that Michael Haneke has made.
I know, yeah. I mean, like, Benny's video just makes me just want to jump off the couch. I'm so excited.
It's a great Friday viewing.
Yeah, cachet. But he, with Verhoeven, is like, regardless of the subject matter, he just knows how to, like, make these propulsive, like, narratives. Like,
he's an entertainer.
He's an entertainer. It's like, whatever you're dealing with here. And he's so good, again, at, like, balancing the experience of like, this is really uncomfortable subject matter, but also like, I am thoroughly entertained.
Right.
You know,
I mean, it also comes from the fact that like, you know, he's very candid about, you know, his earliest memories about going to the theater and everything were to see, it was during the Nazi occupation of Holland when he was a boy, and that, you know, his earliest memories of seeing movies were like Nazi propaganda movies and movies that were made to get a rise out of you and like inspire, we'll say, like people to join the Nazi party and, you know, and valorize their heroes. You know, that was what taught him cinematic language when he was a boy, like he
and would, iconography and,
exactly and he also relays a story about finding like a downed Nazi plane in the field behind his home and finding the pilot dead inside of it when he was a kid, and like that was his earliest relationship with death, of like just seeing all of these people fighting for a cause around him that would just die, and he translates that, and that obviously never left him, because like there's a reason why the propaganda films inside of Starship Troopers are so dead on accurate despite taking place, you know, hundreds of years into the future during the space war. You know, the same way with like, to take it back to RoboCop, which we haven't really talked about that much yet, is that, you know, all of those interstitial commercials that come up during RoboCop, you know, with the "you nuked my battleship" and all that shit, like, no more military aid. Yeah, like there's a reason why he's so good at satirizing, you know, American commercial products and everything, because like he's always viewed it through that lens of watching propaganda. You know, and to him, all of that stuff is propaganda. It just depends what it's trying to sell you.
I mean, like the heart commercial, everything. Yamaha, you choose the heart. And remember, we care. Like, it's so... And I remember growing up in that era, too. Like, that's what commercials were like. I mean, like, it's not far... It's such good satire. It's so close to reality.
Well, I mean, and right. even like the I'd buy that for a dollar, dude, like that apparently was based on a guy who was in Detroit who basically would just do that during the commercials, because like that's the thing about the I'd buy that for a dollar guy is that like that feels like a local commercial. Like everybody, no matter if you've lived in Philadelphia or Austin or Detroit, like we all have. It's like when you see the Alan Comey, the attorney who rocks poster on the side of like buses here and on billboards in like Austin, is that like everybody has that local fucking weirdo that you're like, all right, that's strange that that even exists. But and somebody not only does it exist, but like put money into like funding a guy with a weird catchphrase or who like is a lawyer with dreads who represents you in a DUI case.
It's also, I was thinking about way back to the idea of the comic book kind of proto comic book stuff, is that the first movie feels so similar to Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns. Miller eventually writes part two.
Yeah.
And it's like,
and it's so Frank Miller,
and it's the same idea. It's this like farcical thing of like Reagan's America. There's a lot of like newscasts, there's commercials, there's this whole thing, while outside is a fucking hellhole. Now Miller has got, his point of view is not the best, but it is interesting they brought him in to do the sequel.
RoboCop 2 is psychotic.
I love it.
It's a psychotic movie.
But that also, you know, goes to show the power and crazy control of Verhoeven, right? That
right.
he was able to like hit that perfect pitch of it. Again, hitting, you can experience it as a fun action movie, horror movie if you want, body horror, but also...
Because RoboCop 2 is Irvin Kershner, right?
Yeah.
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 The Empire Strikes Back, and that guy couldn't nail it. Because, like, you might like RoboCop 2, and there's a lot about RoboCop 2 that I like quite a bit, too. But, like, it doesn't hold a candle to the original.
Oh, it's not even close. Now, it's a great sequel when you're 12, right? Again, to your original point.
When that one robot shoots itself in the head.
I'll never forget
still
that.
Still one of the funniest images I've ever seen in my life.
Dude, I had the Dark Horse comicization of RoboCop 2. I still have it somewhere at my parents' house. But Frank Miller wrote that, too. Like
That makes sense.
He wrote the comic. And I remember that part, and I was a kid, I'm like, so my parents are like, you like RoboCop? Here's this comic. And I'm like, whoa. Like,
this is crazy.
This is some crazy shit, dude.
And then one of our boys did part three and failed. There's stuff about part three I actually kind of like. Yeah, RoboCop 3 with Fred Decker, yeah. Shane Black's old partner.
PG-13.
Monster Squad. I mean, RoboCop fights ninjas in it. That's kind of cool. And he flies at a certain point.
The cyborg guy with the samurai sword is badass.
Yeah.
Like, there's some cool shit, but it's not.
It's a mess. And even Decker has said, like, they kind of took it away from him,
yeah.
And turned it into something else.
And it's not Weller.
But, I mean, I know that there was a lot of meddling, too, in RoboCop 2, as well as that they toned down a lot of the shit that Miller wanted to do. But I think that's what makes you appreciate the original RoboCop even more, is that it's uncut Verhoeven.
Yeah.
Like, and uncut in a way that, like, you know, he had to more or less, like, negotiate with the MPAA to get half of the shit into the movie, because... I mean, we've talked about offline, like one of the earliest Criterion editions that was appealing to everybody was that Laserdisc and then DVD of RoboCop.
I spent $60 on that.
That had the uncut version of like the boardroom scene and all the gore
and
everything.
And that's it.
And that's it. All it was a few squibs in one scene that stood between that movie and an X rating.
I already had it on DVD, and I spent $60.
And when you watch them side by side, it's really not that different.
No.
But it's also, to Verhoeven's point, is that, like, there's the famous story that he tells about that moment, is that, you know, it's the boardroom scene where Dick Jones and everybody brings in Ed 209. They volunteer one guy. Ed 209 goes wrong, blows him away, and shoots him, like, 80 times. And, like, the MPAA's objection was there's too many squibs. He gets shot too many times. And Verhoeven's like, well, that's the point. Because if you only get shot a couple times, it's more disturbing because he dies and it's like realistic. If you shoot him 80 times and show it, it suddenly becomes hilarious.
Yep. He said it's more violent to do less. And yeah, I remember I got that home and I was like, I had no regrets because I love RoboCop so much.
Yeah, we had a copy of it at Vulcan for the longest time. And like, I remember taking it home to watch the difference and being like, oh, it's basically the same. Like, you really can't tell that much. I mean, and this is also a movie where, like, our hero shoots the dick off of a rapist at one point.
It's...
And then tells the victim to go to a rape crisis center.
It's kind of like you said, it's all Verhoeven, you know, and obviously, was it Edward Neumeier and Michael Miner who wrote the screenplay, I think? Yeah, and it's like, those guys put together a really great script, but it does feel like all the subtext is Verhoeven. Like, he added all that. I'm sure it was there already, the anti-corporate America stuff, but, like, he really...
Amps it up,
yeah.
I mean, it's in the same way that, like, people wildly misunderstood Starship Troopers when it first came out, is that they were like, wait, what are we watching? Is this supposed to be a comedy? Are they supposed to be acting like soap opera stars and everything? And it's like, and it's all there and heightened for, like, a reason. Like, he wants to get you on board with a certain version of reality. In RoboCop, the version of reality is just, like, again, his usual fascinations of, like, genderless showers together, yeah, and hyper violence in the streets. Drugs and crime have overridden everything. Capitalism reigns. But the capitalism reigns part is probably the most prescient bit of the movie, in that the militarization of the police force and everything. I mean, there's not a whole lot of difference between what we're seeing in the streets today. All we're basically missing is robots between the way the cops are today.
Well, and they're taking over in other ways.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, so, and I saw this thing today about, you know, all these data centers all over the country that are just, like, you know, sucking power. You know, they're tricking us into thinking, oh, it's like to have fun Pokemon memes, but that's just for the surveillance state eventually. Like, that's just like getting ready for when that happens. You're like, cool. Like, we're getting closer and closer to these.
Well, you again, know, proving why
dystopian.
Eddington's the most prophetic piece of cinema to come out of 2025.
Yeah, good stuff. Good stuff.
But who's the... So, we haven't really gotten to the cast of RoboCop yet either, which is, like, one of the greatest collection of weirdo character actors to ever hit one screen. Like, Ronnie Cox is Dick Jones.
Yeah.
Like, and he would do that role again for Verhoeven with Cohagen in Total Recall.
Yeah.
You know, he's basically, he really, like, Verhoeven finds a thing that these actors are really good at doing and again exploits the shit out of it. And it's the same with Miguel Ferrer, you know, as the sleazy boardroom, like, climbing, like, coke addict. Dude, that moment where Clarence Boddicker, like, busts in on his party where he's just doing coke off of, like, two chicks' tits and, like, then gets grenaded is amazing.
I'm cashing you out, Billy Boy.
Billy Boy. And also Dan O'Hara as the old man in OCP.
Yeah, he, and then...
Halloween 3, baby.
Ray, you have fucking Ray Wise as one of Clarence Boddicker's guys. You have Kurtwood Smith as one of, I mean, top five 80s villains, because he's so fucking funny. The most, one of the most quotable villains in the history of, like, 80s action horror, sci-fi, anything. Like,
can you fly, get, Bobby?
Bitches leave, you know. Or it was like, the Tigers are playing tonight. I never miss a game. Like, it just goes on forever and ever. And, like, I love, too, like, in hindsight, watching it now, the realism of, you're getting your ass kicked by a robot, and you're going to be like, I'm going to spill the beans about everything. He's like, I work for Dick Jones, man. Yeah. Which is completely realistic.
Dick Jones!
I work for Dick Jones! And then he spits that blood out. It's just so fucking good, man.
I mean, Peter Weller as fucking Alex Murphy and RoboCop, like, and also bringing in Nancy Allen to be
one of the weaker
partner.
Parts of the movie, I think.
You think so? Yeah. I like her in the movie.
I like her, but Val did call out, and again, first time watching, she goes, what's her deal? And she's a little cheese ball. She can be, but I like the Murphy, it's you. Like,
well, I mean, Nancy Allen was always sort of like an over the top, bubbly performer. I mean, my favorite movie of all time is Blowout, and, like, I remember seeing it for the first time and being like, is Nancy Allen doing that on purpose? Or
he,
like,
goes to Sugar Babies and...
But you kind of just fall in love with her. I think you fall in love with her in every movie. There's a reason why De Palma married her.
Yes.
You know, but I mean, like, Weller, for even as weird as he is, like, he's perfect for RoboCop, man. That fucking voice, the way he commits to the role, like, he treats that like he's doing fucking Shakespeare.
Well, and it's like Batman, too, where you're most of the movie, you're only seeing the bottom part of his face. So he's really gotta bring it. And just, like, honestly, I remember, like, when the first time I saw this, my brother and I would just walk around the house pretending to do the robot body movement. Like, he's amazing. Like, it's so... It's so good. And again, Basil Polidori's score is just like, oh my God. It's amazing. What do you think? Okay, hopping over real quick to Showgirls. I think it's an interesting case study as when one of his movies doesn't work. And we were texting about it. We were going to be talking about it. That it might have been the fact that the screenwriter and director were on two different wavelengths, what the movie was going to be.
Yeah. And yeah, Joe Esterhaas. Who was the hottest screenwriter in Hollywood at the time.
Who did Basic Instinct.
Who did Basic Instinct and also did Jade for William Friedkin.
Fatal Attraction.
Fatal Attraction. He's like an incredible screenwriter. Do you ever see the movie, that Casagarvis movie, Betrayed?
No.
About the white supremacist with like Tom Berenger in it?
No.
Also pretty fucking good. He wrote that movie. Like he's written a lot of shit that we really like. He's also a disgusting human being, if you've read anything about him whatsoever.
Yeah.
But he, I don't think there's a satirical bone in Esterhaas's body. And I think that's where the collision happens. It's like a worldview difference, is that where Verhoeven sees Showgirls and is like, this is my way to almost do like, All That Jazz, but with fucking strippers, or A Star Is Born with strippers.
Yeah.
But do the tongue-in-cheek version of it. Esterhaas is like, we're going to really explore the world of Las Vegas showgirls and like the power dynamics of what really happens here. We're like, Verhoeven's like, this is just all plastic nonsense the entire time, and I find it wildly entertaining. Now, I think that push-pull between the two worldviews, along with Elizabeth Berkley's just frankly heinous central performance.
That's the problem.
I know that there's been a movement to reclaim this movie as some kind of like misunderstood work of art. And I think there's some validity to some of it, especially from the filmmaking. But the one part I can't get on board with is when people try to say, well, she's bad on purpose, or she's doing a very affected bit of acting. And I'm like, I just think she's miscast. I think he's doing something similar to what he does with Starship Troopers, where he looked at Starship Troopers and he was like, what if I cast everyone in this as basically like soap opera actors, Beverly Hills 90210 grade performers, Doogie Howser is like a psychic, you know, Nazi who works his way up to the highest ranks. Like, there's a tongue-in-cheek element to the way that he's putting performance in those roles that actually stands in stark contrast to what he does with RoboCop, to where with RoboCop, those guys, for as heightened as that world is, they all feel like working stiffs inside of it. They feel like real characters. There's no real kind of... For an artificial movie, there's no real artifice to the way the actors perform. To where in Starship Troopers, it's all artifice and plasticity. And I think he's trying to employ that same casting ethos to Showgirls with Elizabeth Berkley in particular, but also like Kyle MacLachlan, his weird role. Like he might be the worst part of the movie, and I love Kyle MacLachlan. He's horrible in Showgirls. Like, that hair that he has the entire time is like comedically awful,
and the really bad spray tan.
Like, it's really bad. You know who actually gets what that movie is the best?
Gina Gershon. I think she gets it.
Yes, and Robert Davi.
Yes,
Robert Davi's terrific in as the lower the rent. Strip club manager before she kind of ascends to the big time, you know. I think he knows exactly what fucking movie he's in the same way that Gershon knows exactly what fucking movie she's in. It's just that the rest of it, And then you also have like the collision of like when Verhoeven does engage in violence, because he's very good at playing violence for comedy and also playing violence to shock you and sexual violence to shock you. Like the rape scene in Showgirls is the part that loses the majority of the audience with that one, because all of a sudden it goes from this high camp, goofy kind of stripper pseudo musical to this hard edged drama about a woman getting raped behind the scenes. And it's like the tones just don't quite line up.
Well, it's also like really out of left field. Cause like you said, like, but it's also like weirdly the way they're performing, like that guy screams wet pussy and then dives on her. Like, it's like, what the fuck?
It's
like,
yeah, it's just handled very, you know, for a guy who's usually very good at this type of thing, it's handled pretty poorly.
Well, and to your point too, like, I mean, I've heard the same thing, people talking about how like, they're like, oh no, this is actually, it's like, yeah, it's camp by today's standards, but like, you know,
they were making it, they weren't making it as camp.
No, it was a huge budget fucking movie. It's like from the filmmakers behind Basic Instinct, monster hit.
Right.
Right. So the film right after it, it was there was the follow up. And I also remember, but like Elizabeth Berkley in particular, and this is not to blame her, is so bad. And that's again, for me, the litmus test of, oh, this is just, the movie was didn't work the way they planned. Like, she was not the person to cast. It also, remember from, you know, I think I was in fifth grade when this came out, and it was, everyone's talking about the girl from Saved by the Bell is going to be fully naked.
Yeah.
Like, that was part of the ad campaign.
But, I mean, that's part of Verhoeven's fascination, is that he takes these actors like Doogie Howser,
yeah,
or the girl from Saved by the Bell, and he's like, what if I put them in a situation that you just totally don't expect right to ever see them in?
Him as a Nazi, like you said, yeah.
When again, he's exploiting our iconography,
yeah,
that is now like Elizabeth Berkley at that time was like a household name. I don't know if they knew her name, but they all knew her as the girl from Saved by the Bell,
yep,
just in the same way that, you know,
Neil Patrick Harris.
Yeah, Neil Patrick Harris was Doogie Howser to everybody. Like, he's very much in tune with, like, these are the things that you people like, but I'm gonna twist them a little bit and pervert them.
Yes.
You ready to do questions?
Yes, sir.
All right. With questions about Paul Verhoeven's RoboCop. Martin, will just fire away right off the bat. Top three, Verhoeven, go.
Number three, I'll do Starship Troopers. Saw this when it first came out. Was obsessed. Bought the toys even. Again, the hilarity of that.
Of buying, know, Starship Trooper toys.
No, yeah, just that it was, again, the studio was like, we know this is farce. We're still going to make fucking money off this shit. They made a sequel. They made an animated movie. Number two would be Basic Instinct. This would be fucking rips. Jan de Bont's photography, showed it to Val too. And it just is such an amazing like take on Vertigo. He's like playing with all this like San Francisco iconography of, and the blonde who's basically leading on the main character. It's just, it's awesome.
It's the highest form of what that very specific erotic thriller is, yes, supposed to feel like.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, and again, it's one of those things, it's similar in a way. It's funny that you have another actress who's worked with Verhoeven. Like, I think Wild Things works in a similar way of, like, it's sexy, but also a really cool take on, like, the Southern
foil. Florida noir.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like if Just Cause were hot. And then number one's RoboCop, forever. That's easy for me.
Yeah, number one's RoboCop for me. 2 and 3 are where it gets kind of difficult because, like...
I like Total Recall a lot, too.
I love Total Recall. It fucking rips.
I watch it a lot.
Basic Instinct's probably 2 for me. 3... Man, we haven't even talked about... I mean, L's probably number 3 for me. Because, I mean, like, I just... Again, it's the most Verhoeven. But, I mean, we haven't even talked about, like... Spetters,
yeah,
you know, the movie that lost him Return of the Jedi, allegedly, because, you know, Soldier of Orange comes out, Spielberg's a huge fan of Soldier of Orange, he brings Paul Verhoeven over to the United States, he interviews to do Return of the Jedi, and then he makes Spetters in the meantime, and there's a gang rape scene in Spetters that's so violent and upsetting and gross if you know what happens inside of it, that I guess the studio executives or someone got a hold of it and saw it, and they're like, well, we can't let this fucking guy make a Star
Wars
movie.
That's not happening. Yeah.
So who knows? He's going to have, like, the fucking Ewoks, like, raping Princess Leia or something. Like, we can't let this guy loose on a set. But, I mean, the thing with Verhoeven is that it's almost like you could go through his entire filmography and not be bored, and... They're all, even his worst movies, are interesting and fascinating in different ways. Like, Flesh and Blood is fucking great.
Yeah.
You know?
They also is just gorgeous.
They're gorgeous. I mean, because that's another Jan de Bont shot movie. You know, Joseph Vacano, his other cinematographer who does most of his movies, like, and came over, you know, from Holland with him. Like, he works with the same guys every time. Basil Polidorus does a lot of the scores for the movies.
Yeah,
like,
Jerry Goldsmith.
Jerry Goldsmith does, you know, the Hollow Man score. And, like, it's
Basic
just
Instinct.
Basic Instinct. Like, it's, he knows, he has collaborators that believe in his very wacky vision. I mean, again, like, Hollow Man is probably his worst movie, maybe. It's definitely his worst big budget movie.
I think it's better than Showgirls.
Are we sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I think it also has, it has lower aspirations.
Well, let's put it this way. Out of all of his thrillers, I would rank Hollow Man the last, but it's still, like, so wildly entertaining the whole time. Like, and it's it also, viewing it this time around, pointed something else out to me, is that Paul Verhoeven is obsessed with making all of his main characters wildly unlikable. Like, he has no problem putting an asshole front and center.
Well, also, like, watch the movie again. Like, talk about some really advanced special effects for the time. Like, it's crazy what it...
Oh, that when the gorilla...
Oh.
Like, disintegrates, it...
Or just everything with just him, like, with having, like, the sensors on this invisible body, and, like, the fact that every time he has that mask on, they had to put CGI on the back to show the inside of the... It's just, like, they made it so difficult for themselves, and it must have been a nightmare for all the compositors, but, like, it looks, honestly, still...
Still kills.
Still kills. And it's just, honestly, a fun horror movie, you know? I think it's a fun horror, like, sci-fi...
Another very rapey movie, too. Oh, like, all the voyeuristic stuff. Like, it becomes a Brian De Palma movie at a certain point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that one scene is like, well, it's rough.
Yeah, it's...
Yeah.
All of it's pretty rough. But also, like, you know, Kim Dickens is in that movie before Deadwood.
Yeah.
You know, Elizabeth Shue, back when you could still put Elizabeth Shue in a movie.
As the, she gets top billing over Kevin Bacon in that movie.
And she's fucking hot. In that movie, like, smoking hot.
Yeah.
And you forget, like, she shows up, and I was like, oh, yeah, there was a period of time where, like, Elizabeth Shue would, like, just melt faces.
And Bacon is, like, the most unlikable he's ever been.
Oh, he's a horrible heel. In it. That or something like Maxine or whatever. But he's purposefully unlikable in that. Like, right. That's the thing, is that, like, it's a great example of Verhoeven being, like, same thing with kind of Johnny Rico. Johnny Rico is such a... spoiled, smacked ass, like, rich kid the entire time, who then is basically molded into a unstoppable force of the state, or tool of the state, a killing machine, a marine. And, like, Verhoeven recognizes in these people of being like, you don't have to like somebody to find them compelling.
And also, Casper Van Dien, not a good actor.
Like, horrible actor.
But they tried to make him a thing for a little bit. Didn't fucking happen.
I'll tell you what, though. When he delivers the line, I'm from Buenos Aires, and I say kill them all, That literally gives me chills each time because you watch a guy go from, you know, basically dumb rich high schooler to true believer in that one moment. And it's especially watching Starship Troopers now. This is the one thing. This was a unique viewing experience for me this time around because, like, I saw it in theaters too with my parents when it first came out. I've always found it amusing for the most part and highly entertaining. Watching it now is like, especially when we exist in a world of Twitter and constant propaganda and right-wing nonsense like around us and people literally being programmed by these images that they see at all times and being recruited into MAGA or fucking Turning Point after Charlie Kirk and everything or ICE. Like, it's Starship Troopers takes on a different meaning now when you watch it. And it's, I found this viewing like kind pretty upsetting.
And RoboCop too. I mean, they both are just really, really just like, well, and again, fascism is not creative. It's always the same.
Yeah, it's a blunt instrument.
And it's just a cycle. It's just the same shit with different technology, but it just fucking.
And I mean, again, it's the echoes of a guy who grew up in a Nazi occupied country who was, you know, exposed to the very things that we accuse Trump and all these guys of doing now, is that like he knows that if it looks and smells like it, it probably is fascism.
Well, he did amazing. I mean, Soldier of Orange again, that was a shocking viewing to me watching in 2025, was again just that slow creep of fascism. And you have those moments, those little moments of how a joke turns into reality. You know, you hear people joking about their Jewish friend, and then a couple scenes later, they're wearing the stars.
Yeah.
You know, you see this movement.
And it's, that's the more, it's strange to watch them in comparison because Soldier of Orange is, while it's a realistic, it's also sort of like the naive take on fascism.
Yeah.
To a certain degree, despite it being made by a guy who lived in it, is that the slow creep. That's not how it happens. Like, it's very much all of a sudden it's here and it's around you at all times. And it almost feels like Starship Troopers, for as satirical as it is, almost feels like a more truthful depiction of the way fascism is spread on like a wider level.
Yeah.
Because it's almost just kind of like once you know what it looks like and it's here, like it just starts hitting you like a sledgehammer.
Yeah. I guess maybe a different way to put it too is like, not even the slow creep of fascism, but how fascism eventually touches the people who think they're untouchable.
Yeah.
You know, how it creeps, because it's like, it's there in that movie very, very quickly in Soldier of Orange, but then you have...
That's what makes that movie so powerful.
Yeah, because you had the moment, too, these guys are like, and it's not this heroic thing of like, we have to act. It's more like, well, what are we going to do?
We're left with no other choice.
At first, it's almost like, let's just get to England. Like, at first, it's just out of necessity. Like, we got to get out of here.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, I guess we could be spies.
Yeah.
You know, very matter of fact.
So, double feature with RoboCop.
I'm going to do The Crow. Very, very similar plot. Also about a resurrection story. Also a great comic booky movie. And also in Detroit. It's a lot of connections. But the difference being there's not an ounce of cynicism in The Crow.
It's very emo.
Or satire. It is like love is real, romance is real, death is, you know, it's like I said, very, very emo. I think they pair really well together. They both just have that totally like, and they're only, 7 years apart, which is crazy to think. Like, they're really in that same time period. Also, both before, like, the comic book boom of, like, the late 90s into the early 2000s. So I would do that.
I'm doing Darkman.
Yeah.
Our last entry.
Yeah. I mean, all three pair.
They literally feel like they take place down the block from one another.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
It's insane that, like, Darkman, I swear, is set in Detroit. Like, because, and they almost follow the same exact plot of, like, you have the main bad guy, you know,
who's
a developer. No.
Oh, sorry. Main bad guy. And then his underling.
Who's a developer. You have, like, almost like these white collar bad guys who are teamed up with street level thugs. All in service of like a greater vision, because like the whole idea in Detroit is making New Detroit and making this utopian cleaned up version of the city. It's the same thing that the bad guy in Darkman is essentially doing and partnering with Larry Drake and trying to you know, acquire all of that property and everything for his vision. Like, they play so well together to the point to where, like, the shootouts at the industrial, like, mills, it feels like the same mill when you watch them back to back. I just think these movies would play incredibly well as a double bill together.
Again, but same, very similar plot to The Crow as well, where you have this guy's invincible until he's not.
Yeah.
You know, the way when the Crow gets shot, now he can be killed. RoboCop, when now he's vulnerable. It's very similar kind of action plotting.
And a tragic love story.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Remake. Redo. I mean, it's already been remade with Joel Kinnaman. I actually don't mind that movie.
It's not terrible.
I'm going to be the first. It also has an insane cast with Gary Oldman and
Jackie Earle Haley.
Like
Samuel Jackson.
It's a weird film.
And it's the guy who did Elite Squad.
Yeah.
From Brazil. Like, it's not terrible.
Juan Carlos Fasanillo, I want to say his name is. It's not bad.
It looks awesome.
Is it good? No. But it's watchable.
Yeah.
But
and PG-13.
Here's the question. Why have we not had a new RoboCop? This feels like a thing.
It's 11 years ago that movie came out.
That's what I mean. Yeah. But this also feels like a thing. You know, we're now in an era, we're recording this episode where Amazon, you know, has bought Heat 2 today. It's been announced that they're officially doing Heat 2 with Michael Mann. It's gone to United Artists and Amazon. They've also gotten James Bond, and you know, they hired Denis Villeneuve to do Bond. They're going to have Michael Mann obviously do Heat 2.
They got fuck you money to make these movies.
Like, they have fuck you money to make these movies. And they're also obviously very invested in the IP of it all.
Right.
RoboCop just feels like intellectual property that's like prime real estate to be exploited, and I don't understand why nobody's snatched that one up.
Well, especially because of the fact you have, because Alien and Predator are both Disney, which surprised me we haven't had an AVP movie yet, which I think Badlands is kind of.
I was gonna say it looks like, and it's been hinted that, because I mean, like,
she's an android from Weyland,
from Weyland-Yutani. Like, they're very much building towards an Alien versus Predator, like, proper crossover
that
ignores the Paul W.S. Anderson movies.
And isn't Terminator 1 still owned by Sony MGM?
I think so.
Yeah, I mean, that's the release one. So it's like, I'm not sure what the ownership is in terms of part 2 and the IP when it comes to like Cameron, but like Terminator versus RoboCop. Like, they're all about these like world building crossover movies. So it's like kind of writes itself.
Yeah. You know? I think, like, who would you want to see do an actual, if you were to just do a one-off remake of RoboCop, what filmmaker would you want to see do it?
Strangely, Lee Whannell.
And he's kind of already done it with Upgrade.
Yeah, Upgrade and Invisible Man, just being these great tech-heavy.
He's very much a Cronenberg and Verhoeven kind of acolyte.
They're gory as fuck. The action is insane. It's also, like, really low budget. Like, he does a lot with a little. I wouldn't mind seeing, like, a smaller kind of take. I don't need a huge epic RoboCop.
Let me throw a name at you and just see what you think. What about Timo?
That'd be insane.
Imagine that's more what I mean. Like, imagine the guy that we currently have who's the best at violence being like, you're allowed to do RoboCop now. Like, what does that look like?
I mean, I almost picture it what Fede, actually Fede wouldn't have been bad, you know, as
ooh,
well.
Fede Alvarez, for as complicated as my relationship is to some of his movies, like, his RoboCop would be real mean.
Yeah, I mean, just how he took Evil Dead from a gory, but then made it, like, really mean, and then do the same thing of, like, imagine RoboCop ripping people's fucking jaws off. Just be, like, just, it would just be, and the same with Timo, a complete gore fest.
Well, also a guy who, like, is obviously interested with, as much as neither one of us really liked Romulus that much, but he's obviously fascinated by the dystopian elements.
Yeah.
Of the future, like, I think Fede Alvarez would actually do pretty well with the dystopian aspects of Detroit
and industrial, OCP.
Yeah, like,
the style.
And well, and again, the rise of fascism and everything. Like, I think you would have a lot of fun with that. That's actually a pretty good call. So, Face Melter.
1,000%.
Like,
it just happened to my girlfriend. She's like, what the hell is this movie?
Well, let's complicate the question then, since this one was so easy. How many face melters does Verhoeven have?
So,
definitely RoboCop.
RoboCop. I think Total Recall.
Total Recall for sure.
Basic Instinct.
Basic Instinct.
I don't know
if Basic Instinct is.
I mean,
it's pretty close.
We've had to redefine what face melter means in terms of but that movie is, and again, showed it to her for the first time, and it just rips. Like, Starship's hands down easily.
Yeah.
One. I don't think Hollow Man as much as I like it.
No.
And then I don't think.
Have you ever seen Showgirls on the big screen?
I never have.
It's an experience. I saw it on 35 millimeter when they played it on the Ritz some years ago, and it's not only a great looking movie, but like it plays with an audience, especially an audience who's not necessarily just approaching it to laugh at it, but to actually try and talk about it. Cause that was kind of the main point of that screening, however many years ago that was. That was kind of at the beginning of that reclamation period. I don't know if it's a face melter, but it's an interesting experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but anyway, Martin, this has been great. We finally knocked RoboCop off the list. What do we have next?
I have no idea.
I thought we were talking about doing one of your movies, a very lo-fi 70s bit of horror, especially since we're in spooky season.
Oh, yeah.
We were talking about doing Let's Scare Jessica to Death, so I think that might be it. Might pair a couple other lo-fi American horror 70s movies with it.
Yeah.
But you'll have to tune in and see what exactly those are when we also figure them out together. So see you then.
See ya.